Where do I put this fire? This bright red feeling. This tiger lily down my mouth. He wants to grow to 20 feet tall. I've left Bethlehem and I feel free. I've left the girl I was supposed to be. Someday I'll be born. I'm so tired of being shy. I'm not that girl anymore. I'm not that straight A anymore. Now I wanna sit my legs wide open and laugh so loud that the whole damn restaurant will turn and look at me. Look at the tiger jumping out of her.
History. It's a collection of stories that give us some sense of where we come from and who we come from. Like myths, our historic tales inform us about our values. These stories tell us how to avoid problems, even if we're destined to do the same old things as those before us and, as typical, repeat the past. Have you noticed how history changes as values change? Yes, history reinforces values. And it's rewritten all the time as the values reinforce history. We have to interpret and reinterpret if we want a chance to understand the events of yesterday in light of today's perspective. History is told from the perspective of the leaders, the winners, the educated, and those with leisure time, the privileged. But wealth of this sort is being shared among more and more groups, and these groups start to claim their own histories. And we begin to realize that all groups, even those that are completely marginalized, have their histories, their stories. All these concepts are behind women's history and today's show, the collection of stories about women, who we are, who went before, what she did, and how she lived, worked, thought, and valued. How that history affects us and her stories affect us and our place in society today. How her actions affect us today. These crucial factors are about us are embedded in our stories, in her stories. Today, we're going to share a few of those. From KRFP in Moscow, Idaho, this is Yin Radio, and I'm Sandy Billings. Our program today is timely for Women's History Month. It's her story. Women's history makes most of us think, if we think way back, to the fight for the vote, for women's suffrage. It really wasn't that long ago, you know. Our grandmothers were the first to have the right to vote in this country, yet we take it for granted. For installment number one, Anna Maria Roque brings us a primer on women's suffrage in the U.S.
Give me liberty or give me death. Patrick Henry, an American hero.
Apples and oranges.
In oranges and women. Courage is often mistaken for insanity.
August 18, 1920, was a day many women now take for granted. It was a day that came after years and years of fighting by women such as Sojourner Truth, Susan B. Anthony, Alice Paul, and Lucy Burns to get us women one step closer to gender equality. Of course, I am talking about the day the 19th Amendment of the U.S. Constitution was ratified, guaranteeing women the right to vote. The amendment is a mere 2 lines long and reads, "The right of citizens of the United States to vote shall not be denied or abridged by the United States or by any state on account of sex. Congress shall have power to enforce this article by appropriate legislation." The 19th Amendment was the culmination of the work of many activists in favor of women's suffrage. Starting in 1917, one such group called the Silent Sentinels, organized by Alice Paul, protested in front of the White House during Woodrow Wilson's presidency. The protests lasted until June 1919, when the 19th Amendment to the United States Constitution passed both the House of Representatives and the Senate. During those 2.5 years, more than 1,000 different women picketed every day and night except Sunday. Rain, snow, or heat, those women stood outside the building, holding their suffrage flags and withstanding ridicule and harassment.
Get over here. Come on. Get off the streets. Go home to your mother.
Over 30 of those women were arrested on charges for obstructing traffic, and Alice Paul herself spent 7 months in prison for protesting. In prison, Alice Paul began a hunger strike, and others joined in. In response to this rebellious hunger strike, prison doctors placed Paul in a psychiatric ward and threatened to transfer her to an insane asylum. She still refused to eat. Doctors became afraid that she might die, so 3 times a day for 3 weeks, they forced a tube down her throat and poured raw eggs mixed with milk down her throat. One physician reported that Paul had a spirit like Joan of Arc. She will die, but she will never give up. Meanwhile, the other detained women were grabbed, dragged, beat, choked, pinched, and kicked by women guards. It wasn't long before newspapers carried stories about how the protesters were being treated, and the women were soon released. Later, the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals declared all the suffrage arrests, trials, and punishments had been unconstitutional. On January 9, 1918, President Woodrow Wilson announced his support of the amendment. The next day, the House of Representatives narrowly passed the amendment, but the Senate refused to even debate it until October. When the Senate voted on the amendment in October, it failed by 3 votes. In response, the National Women's Party urged citizens to vote against anti-suffrage senators up for re-election. After the 1918 midterm election, most members of the Congress were pro-suffrage. On May 21, 1919, the House of Representatives passed the amendment, and the Senate followed on June 4. Finally, those two little lines the women had suffered for so long were ratified on August 18, 1920.
Installment number 2 on our Her Story show comes from early modern Europe. Hortense and Marie Mancini were among the first women in history to write and to publish their memoirs. Their memoirs were famous even in their own time. That was the late 1600s. And they remain in print today, in many languages. Last year, Sarah Nelson published a new English translation of the memoirs, complete with annotations that describe who the various characters are that come in and out of the pages of those women's lives, with essential historical references as well. Makes it very accessible to all of us. So why were Hortense and Marie famous? They grew up in court, for one, alongside Louis XIV. Marie was known as Louis's first great love, in a story that came to be famous in itself, especially since he was not allowed to marry her, and instead he married for reasons of state. So that made it noticeable when these two respectable women, married to respectable men, ran away from their husbands. And they never went back, and they lived on the run. Not to mention that they wrote about it and they became best-selling authors. Just how unusual it was for a woman to write a memoir, to talk publicly about herself at all during that time, is a little hard to imagine today. The introduction to Hortense's memoir gives some insight. Here's translator Sarah Nelson.
This is the opening of Hortense's memoir, which was written in 1675, and she addresses it to her benefactor, the Duke of Savoy. Since the obligations that I have toward you are such that I must spare no effort to show you my gratitude, I'm quite willing to tell the story of my life as you request. Not that I'm ignorant of the difficulty of speaking judiciously about oneself, and neither are you unaware of my natural reluctance to talk about my own affairs, but it is even more natural to defend ourselves against calumny, at least to those who've done us such great favors. They deserve to be shown that we're not entirely unworthy to have received them. In any case, I could make no more innocent use of the leisure of my retreat. And if the events that I have to recount to you seem like something out of a novel, blame it on my unhappy fate rather than my inclination. I know that a woman's glory lies in not giving rise to gossip, and those who know me know well enough that I do not care for making a public sensation. But one cannot always choose the kind of life one wishes to lead, and there's fate even in the very things that seem to depend most on conduct. So that was the opening of Hortense's memoir.
Almost an apology for what she's writing, because it's right. Not seemly.
Yeah, and she is using a little bit more sort of conventional rhetorical moves at the beginning of a piece of writing, and certainly a personal memoir. Mm-hmm. Modesty is big, even for male writers, to say, you know, like my poor brain doesn't have much to put forward, but since you, my generous benefactor, have asked for it, I'm willing to put this down to writing for you. Yeah. And so it's modesty, and it's also the sort of topos of gratitude towards a benefactor and offering your writing as you know, thanks.
Mm-hmm. In comparison,
there's Marie, who's much more forthright about the exact sort of circumstances in which she's writing. There's been this false memoir that's come out under her name, purporting to be written by her, which just lifted pieces out of Hortense's memoir, because Hortense's memoir had been such a commercial success. So it was trying to just sort of do that again. But it does recount a lot of detail about Marie's life in the period when she was living in Rome. And so it's assumed that it was written by or at least commissioned by somebody that was in the family's circle in Rome, somebody that did know about her life. But it presents her in the sort of negative, frivolous way that she's trying to counter in her own writing, and that both she and Hortense are trying to counter in the way they present themselves in writing. Okay. And the name of her book is The Truth in Its Own Light, or The Genuine Memoirs of Marie Mancini, Constabulus Colonna. It starts out, "As there are no actions upon which the light of public scrutiny shines more harshly than upon those of people in high places, there are also none that are more exposed to censure, nor more easily the target of malicious gossip. And especially in France, where the lampoons meant to libel and to blacken the reputations of those of our sex sell very well and pass for works of court gallantry. But although I was not unaware that there is nothing in the world so sacred that these sorts of works will not attack it, I believed I was beyond the reach of their blows, both by virtue of time and through the propriety of my actions, until I received word from France that there was in circulation a book about my life under my name. This news, along with certain circumstances of which I had been informed, made me curious to see it, and the sight of it has since changed the pique and indignation that I had felt about it into the greatest contempt in the world for its author. For I needn't say here, for those who know me, that there's not a single adventure in it which is not made up and as far from my character as it is from the truth. People who are familiar with my conduct and with my ways will see clearly that this alleged history is a work entirely invented by its author, and even if there are in it some of the incidents of my life, it is so distorted by the circumstances it invents that it is unrecognizable. I will not even mention the baseness of the author's style, and it is practically impossible that his mean expression not reflect the quality of his mind. But since there are people who, because they don't know me, might be susceptible to these sorts of impressions, I felt obliged to preempt the harm they could do me by publishing myself a sincere and genuine account of everything that has happened to me since my tenderest youth, and I was urged to do so by the earnest entreaties of various people who take an interest in all that concerns me, either out of duty or out of inclination."
Marie was the forthright one of the two sisters. Her forthrightness did get her into trouble, too. But before we go there, let's start near the beginning of the story. It was 17th century France. The child Louis XIV was king. Hortense Mancini and Marie Mancini were brought to court by their uncle, the powerful Cardinal Mazarin. Mazarin was politically powerful and incredibly wealthy. He was also a single man without heirs. He regularly brought nieces and nephews to court to raise them and marry them off to increase his power with strong political liaisons. Montferrand brought his nieces, Hortense and Marie, from Rome before they were even 10 years old to prepare them for valuable marriages. When the time came, he matched his niece Hortense to a man who would become his own de facto heir.
Hortense had been chosen of all of the nieces and nephews as the primary heiress to the immense fortune of Mazarin, and so the husband that he chose for her was going to be an important choice, because that man was in fact going to be the one going to have the real power over the fortune. Hortense was in a very unhappy marriage from day one, because the person that her uncle had chosen for her to marry, he needed to find somebody of high enough nobility and some importance, but not so high nobility that this person would refuse to take his name, because what he really wanted was somebody who would carry on the Mazarin name along with the fortune that he was passing on. And so this man, Armand de la Meilleraye, agreed to become the Duc Mazarin, take the name and also all the fortune. But he was, people have said that he might have, that this story of Mazarin and this this potential heir, you know, were possibly the genesis for Molière's Tartuffe, which is the story of a very manipulative man who pretends to be devout and uses his piety to sort of take over the household and fortune of a wealthier man. So this heir was a sort of maniacally pious, very intensely obsessed about anything sexual, had fallen madly in love with Hortense when she was 7 and came to court and he was, you know, 27 or something like that, and had always wanted to marry her till the day he finally got his wish. And then from the time they were married, he was, of course, insanely jealous, protective, tried to keep her away from court. He would make her, travel with him all around France to the places that he'd inherited from Mazarin. And he did really very unbalanced things, like he destroyed the art collection that he had gotten from Mazarin by slathering black paint over nude bodies and chopping off pieces of statues that were, you know, naked body parts and things. So he was a very unusual and, I'd say, deranged man. And so she eventually ran away from him.
And that running away plunged the sisters into fame. Hortense visited Marie and they stole away together. They became household names and were destined to go down in history. Again, translator Sarah Nelson.
They were just famous adventuresses who did something so scandalous that it was kind of hard to imagine. And they write about their travels in disguised as men, taking off in the dead of night with secret sort of negotiations to be able to get post horses to make it from one point to the next without being stopped by the agents of the king. And they eventually sort of make lives for themselves by being the guests of dukes and kings around Europe. So Hortense, at the time she wrote her memoir, she thought that she'd found a safe haven in Chambéry and that she could stay there. But the duke who was her host there died very suddenly, maybe by poison, a couple of months later after the publication of her memoir. So then she had to take off again, and she ended up living the last 20 years of her life at the English court and becoming a very famous person in England, too.
Hortense and Marie's writing have given them a place in history. two of the rare female voices that ring out from that period in European history. The fame was immediate also, because it was a great adventure story. Now, coming up next, Sarah Nelson reads from Marie's memoir, recounting the tale of the sisters leaving Rome together. Hortense has already left her husband and is visiting Marie and her husband in Rome when they take off together.
So I set out on the 29th of May, carrying no more on my person than 700 pistoles, my pearls, and some diamond pendants. And Madame Mazarin, that's her, she always calls her sister by Madame Mazarin, that's Hortense. Madame Mazarin, having lost all her clothes and effects by leaving them in Rome, we got into her coach at a time when the constable, that's Marie's husband, the constable, when the constable had gone to see a stud farm at Fatocchie, which is a house he has in the country. And as we came out of the house, we shouted to the coachman, to Frascati, to fool a crowd of people who were at the Mazarin Palace post station, because Frascati was another family estate and was in the opposite direction from where they were really going, which was the coast and Civitavecchia, which was the main port for Rome at the time. At a turn in the street, a German valet of my sister's named Pelletier, who had had a felucca from Naples made ready at Civitavecchia, told the coachman he had to head straight there, and he threatened to rough him up if he did not go fast. The coachman obeyed, and we arrived on the outskirts of Civitavecchia after nightfall, since the boatman had made an agreement with the valet to come and pick us up 5 miles from town, for fear that we might be recognized at the port. We sent word to them, for we were becoming impatient, waiting for the return of a footman whom we'd sent to them earlier, and this delay caused us more than a little anxiety. Nevertheless, despite all our cares and all the fears we had of being found out, Madame Mazarin and I left the coach, made our way into the thick of a wood near the sea, and went to sleep. And we slept so soundly for 2 hours that my sister's maid, Nanon, and my Morenne, who were keeping watch over us, were as surprised as could be to see us sleeping so peacefully. When we awoke, we saw the valet coming from a distance. He told us that he had not found the boat and that the footman, after having gotten drunk, had stayed at a hostelry to sleep it off. Thus, we saw fit to go back into the coach and to advance a bit further, using a path that was out of the way, for fear that we might be found if we were being followed along the most direct route. But our horses were so exhausted that they could barely stand, which led my sister to say that it would be best to send them back along with the coach to the hostelry opposite Civitavecchia, and to order the coachman to say, if anyone was looking for us, that he had seen us set sail, so that they would not pursue us any further. He promised to do as we asked, in return for a sum of money which we gave him. Meanwhile, we withdrew into the thick of a sort of wood which was near the main road, and ordered Pelletier to go and look for the boat, or else to hire another if he could not find it. He promised to do so, whatever the price. The heat of the sun, which had been pounding down on my head for 5 hours, and which was then at high noon, a forced fast of 24 hours, and my worry over our lack of news about the boat, all threw me into a despair which made me say to my sister that I wanted to turn back, and that I might just as well lose my life in Rome, in whatever way, as die of hunger where we were. But my sister, who is in all the world the most patient woman with the best temperament, bucked me up with her reassurances, adding in the end that if we did not have some favorable news within the half hour, we could always turn back then. And so I resolved to wait that much longer, and hardly a quarter hour had passed when we heard the sound of a horse coming at a gallop. Instantly the fear of being caught, together with the other things agitating my mind, threw me into the greatest dismay in the world. But my sister, who was holding 2 pistols in her hands, realized that it was little La Roche. That was the name of the postillion who had gone to look for the boat without saying anything to us. And she reassured me completely. And all my sadness was changed in a moment into joy by the news that he gave us from as far off as he could make himself heard, that the boat had been found and was waiting for us 5 miles from the place where we were. So we loaded our valises straight away, which were neither terribly heavy nor very numerous. Meanwhile, we went ahead on foot, under the hot sun and in open country, where the only objects we saw were a goodly number of snakes slithering about.
The indefatigable Madame Mazarin led the vanguard and kept striding along, so that when I tried to keep up with her, I had to rest from time to time, hunger, thirst, weariness, and the heat having sapped my spirit and my strength. It reached the point where I was obliged to implore a man who was plowing a field to carry me just some 100 paces toward the sea, telling him that I was a hunter who had lost my servants, for we had changed clothes, my sister and I, in the coach. They'd changed out of their men's clothing and into women's clothing. At first he refused me, but when I added a few pistoles to my, so that's money, to my entreaties, he finally let himself be persuaded. So he carried me in his arms, and in that way I rejoined my sister, and almost immediately Pelletier arrived and told us that he had made a deal on another boat for the sum of 1,000 écus, but that in truth he was not at all pleased with the look of the captain or of the hands, and that they had all seemed to him like very nasty folk. So this goes on at some length. They eventually bargain with the two different crews and get onto the first. And then she talks about the sort of dangerous crossing that they had to get to France. And it's sort of that. It's like that all the way along. It's a rocambolesque. It's sort of like picaresque. It's all kinds of adventures and sort of crazy things happening along the road and everything.
Does sound a lot like an adventure movie. What with sympathetic heroes running from the law, all of society seemingly out to get them, complete with close escapes, disguises, and uncertain alliances. Kind of a Bourne Identity-esque movie, but with famous, gorgeous, real-life women as the stars. Imagine Angelina Jolie on a real-life Jason Bourne run, being followed in the papers and the tabloids. Marie was the one getting into trouble for the most part, though, with her forthright approach and her lack of discretion added on top of their run.
Her biographer says, and you just want to say to her every time she opens her mouth, you just want to say, stop! Because she constantly reports having said something saucy and impolitic to somebody important, and then in the next paragraph she'll say, and then I realized, then, you know, when things got even worse for her, she said, I realized too late my mistake. And so it sort of goes from bad to worse for her. She becomes progressively less free until she ends up sort of mostly imprisoned in convents in Spain.
Marie's troubles started earlier in her life. As a child at court, she was teased mercilessly, as in this recollection in Hortense's memoir.
I was brought to France at the age of 6, which was in 1653. So she says, I was brought to France at the age of 6, and only a few years later, Monsieur Mazarin refused my sister, the constabless, and conceived such an intense passion for me that he once said to Madame d'Aiguillon that if only he could marry me, he would not regret dying 3 months later. He has had even more than he'd hoped for. He has married me and has not died, thank God. When Monsieur le Cardinal first heard of his passion, he seemed so far from approving of it and so outraged by Monsieur Mazarin's refusal of my sister that he said several times that he would rather give me to a valet. He was not the only person whom I had the misfortune to please. An Italian eunuch, a musician to Monsieur le Cardinal and a man of great wit, was accused of the same thing, but in truth, it was as much for my sisters as for me. People jeered that he was even in love with the beautiful statues of the Palais Mazarin, and the love of that man truly must have brought bad luck, since those poor statues have been so cruelly punished for it, just as I have, although they were no guiltier than I. That was that story that I referred to, where her husband, the Duc Mazarin, was driven crazy by the nudity in the works of art in Mazarin's collection, and in the space of one long night he went and slathered black paint over all of these priceless paintings and chiseled off body parts from all of these statues in the collection. If I failed to love as I was loved, it was not for lack of incitement by my sister the constabless. As she felt a sincere attachment to the king, she would have liked very much to see a similar weakness in me. But my extreme youth did not allow me to become attached to anyone, and all I could do to please her was to show some particular interest in those young boys around us who amused me the most in the children's games which occupied me at the time. The presence of the king, who never budged from our quarters, often disturbed them. Although he lived among us with marvelous kindness, there has always been something so serious, so solid, and frankly so majestic in all his manners, that he could not help inspiring awe in us, even without intending to. My sister the constabless was the only person who was not ill at ease with him, and you can easily understand that his attentiveness had charms for those who caused it, which it did not have for others. Since passion makes people do things which seem ridiculous to those who have never felt any, my sister's passion often laid her open to our ribbing. One time, for instance, we teased her when she, seeing from a distance a gentleman of the household, who was the same size as the king, and whom she only saw from behind, had run toward him with her arms open, shouting, "Ah, my poor sire!" My poor sire. Another thing that gave us a good laugh at that time was a joke which Monsieur le Cardinal played on Madame de Bouillon. So Monsieur le Cardinal is their uncle, Mazarin, and Madame de Bouillon. Hortense talks about all of her siblings and people of her family by their titles, by the titles that they would eventually carry as adults. So she's talking about her little sister, Marianne Mancini, but she calls her Madame de Bouillon because that's who she became. Another thing that gave us a good laugh at that time was a joke which Monsieur le Cardinal played on Madame de Bouillon, who must have been about 6 years old. The court was at La Fère at the time. One day, when he was ribbing her about some admirer whom he said she had, he eventually got the idea of reproaching her, claiming that she was with child. The resentment she showed amused him so much that people decided to keep telling her it was so. They took in her clothes from time to time, and they made her think that it was she who had grown fatter. This continued for as long as was necessary to make her think it might be true. But she would never believe a bit of it, and always denied it very sharply, until one morning, when the time had come for the delivery, and she found a newborn child between her sheets. You cannot imagine her astonishment and her dismay at the sight of it. "Well, then," she said, "the Virgin and I are the only ones to whom this has happened, because it didn't hurt a bit." The Queen came to console her and offered to be godmother. Many people came to celebrate with the new mother, and what had begun as a private joke eventually became a public entertainment for the whole court. People pressed her hard to declare who the father of the child was, but all they could draw out of her was that it had to be either the king or the Comte de Guiche, because those were the only two men who had ever kissed her. For my part, being 3 years older than she, I was very proud to know the truth of the matter, and I never tired of laughing about it just to show that I knew it. So then let me skip a little bit ahead to when she's talking about when she was engaged to the guy that became the Duc Mazarin. Meanwhile, Monsieur le Cardinal's health was deteriorating visibly. The desire to perpetuate his name won out over the indignation he had conceived against me. He opened up about it to the Bishop of Fréjus and asked him his opinion on several possible matches whom he had in mind. The bishop, who had been bought off by Monsieur Mazarin with a promise of 50,000 écus, spared no effort to earn them, and yet he never received them. He returned the bond that he'd been given for them straight away, intimating that he would prefer the bishopric of Évreux if possible, but the king had disposed of it otherwise. After 2 months of importuning Monsieur Mazarin, Monsieur de Fréjus asked for the 50,000 écus again, and Monsieur Mazarin was no longer of a mind to give them. As soon as the marriage negotiations were concluded, he sent me a large cabinet in which, among other objects of value, there were 10,000 pistoles in gold. I shared them liberally with my brother and my sisters to console them for my opulence, which my sisters could not see without envy, no matter how they hid it. They did not even need to ask me. The key always remained where it was when the cabinet was brought to me. Whoever wanted to could take from it. And one day, when we had nothing better to do, we threw more than 300 louis out of the windows of the Palais Mazarin for the fun of making a crowd of valets in the courtyard fight over them. This prodigality having come to the attention of Monsieur le Cardinal, he was so displeased by it that people believed it had hastened his death. However that may be, he died 1 week later, and left me the richest heiress and the unhappiest woman in Christendom. When we first heard the news, all that my brother and my sister did by way of grieving was to say to each other, "Thank God he's croaked." To tell the truth, I was hardly any more afflicted, and it is a remarkable thing that a man of his merit, after having worked all his life to exalt and enrich his family, should have received nothing but expressions of aversion from them even after his death. If you knew with what severity he treated us at all times, you would be less surprised by it. Never has a man had such gentle manners in public and such harsh ones at home, and all our temperaments and inclinations were contrary to his. Add to that the incredible subjection under which he held us, our extreme youth, and the insensitivity and carelessness about everything which excessive wealth and privilege ordinarily cause in people of that age, however good a nature they may have.
So in the course of just a few months, Hortense was married to the man who had inherited Cardinal Mazarin's fortune and name. The uncle patriarch Mazarin died, and Marie's marriage to the Roman nobleman was carried out by proxy, and she went to join him in Rome. You know the next plot twist in the story. The sisters leave their husbands, never to return to them, constantly pursued by them, and live outside the normal bounds of courtly women's roles. Hortense did this after first pursuing legal means to try to live apart. She only had one option that might work, only one argument that had a chance.
And the one grounds on which she could start legal action against him for separation was that she could say that he was dissipating the fortune that was entrusted to him and that was supposed to go to their son. Of course, they had three daughters too, but it was supposed to go to their son. That was sort of the only argument that could have stood up in court against him that could be a reason for her to be allowed to live independently from him. And so she pursued it for a while. And she prevailed in one case in the Parliament of Paris, but then it was appealed to a higher court, and she was getting word that it wasn't going well and that it was likely not going to work out for her. And so at that point, she decided that she was going to flee. But he was party to over 100 lawsuits over everything relating to his holdings, his lands, everything throughout his life as inheritor of Mazarin's fortune, and he did really succeed in sort of losing it all by the end of his life. And, you know, people say that they think it's sort of, you know, a psychological thing about him. His religiosity made him feel guilty about all this ill-earned wealth, and so he went about sort of perversely to lose it. But he had one final push in court to make her come back to him, and that was in 1689. So she'd been gone already for over 20 years. And he won in court, and there was a ruling that she was to be deprived of her dowry and that she was forced to leave England and come back to live with him in France. But the thing was that she'd incurred such huge debts by then in England that all of the creditors in England, they were going to have to be paid before she could leave the country. And Mazarin argued that as his wife, she had no legal right to ever have incurred debts without his agreement. So he didn't recognize those debts, so he was not going to pay them. And so she just stayed in England for another 10 years till she died, because he refused to pay her debts to bring her back. And then when she died in 1699, he finally agreed to, okay, I'll pay all those debts. I just want her body back. So he paid all the debts so he could get her body back. And then for a year, he traveled around France to all of his estates with her body in a casket along with him before he finally buried her. Okay? So I told you this guy was not...
Hortense, with all her apparent sense and sensibility, did manage to live out her life free and independent of her husband. Marie, on the other hand, was true to herself and let her passions get in the way.
By this series of kind of bad decisions that seemed clearly to be bad decisions, she has progressively made herself less free. And now she found herself in Spain, in Madrid. She keeps appealing to the sort of the regent queen mother, who's regent for the sort of incompetent Carlos II, I think Charles II of Spain. She keeps appealing to her to be allowed to live freely in a convent. She doesn't want to be imprisoned in a convent. She wants to be able to have the freedom to come and go as she wishes. And that really, really rankles with the Spanish nuns, because I guess Spanish orders of nuns had specific privileges granted to them by the crown, one of which was that they would not be required to house secular ladies like that. But they had been sort of forced to accept her, and then she'd been annoyed by how imprisoned she was and that she didn't have the right to come and go, and so she'd escaped from the convent and run off and gotten sort of taken in by the Marquesa of Mortara, and I can't remember what her husband's role was exactly. I don't know, it's in here someplace. Then she'd been sort of drawn back, forced back in there again by the stepbrother of her husband, who was there supposedly keeping an eye on her. So she accepted to go back in again with the expectation that she was going to petition the queen to be allowed to have the kinds of privileges that she wants. But then she got impatient and she left again. And so it's after, and she's left again, and she's trying to be helped from outside once again. And let's see, it's a passage of about 3 pages. I had given notice of my second exit from the convent, as I had of the first, to the same people whom I mentioned above, and the Marquise had made it known that I was at her house to Monsieur le Président de Castille. Don Ferdinand Colonna had previously suggested to him that he send orders in all directions to arrest me and force me back into a convent, not knowing where I was, and being convinced that my intention was to leave the kingdom. The Almirante, at the solicitation of Don Ferdinand, or else moved by the same spirit, which had long been leading him to take action against me, no sooner learned where I was than he could think of nothing but how to deprive me once again of my freedom. During the short time that I enjoyed it, I was visited by no one but Monsieur le Duc d'Ostune, whom the Marquise had notified, and who said nothing in particular to me during his visit, except that I could not have done better to repair the mistake I had made by coming out of the convent than to withdraw as I had done to a house which had all the sanctity of a convent without the austerity or the constraint. The Prince d'Estienne neither came nor replied, but he behaved very gallantly all the same, sending Don Ferdinand my note and writing to him that he would serve the constable in any way he could. She's very sarcastic. She's very, all through her writing, she's very sarcastic like that. The Almirante, who behaved in just as generous a manner, did not come to see me because he was extremely occupied with business which concerned me. It was, if the inquiring reader wishes to know, a consult which was being conducted against me, until the conclusion of which he put off visiting me. However, I knew nothing of all these actions, of which I have since learned, because there had been no one there who might have given me any knowledge of them at the time, except Monsieur de Lindenau, special envoy of the King of Denmark, a man of probity and honor, who sent a number of messages with one of my maids about what was brewing against me. But since I was not able to speak to him, I attributed these warnings to his zeal, and did nothing to guard against their effects. And although the continual apprehensions that I felt were like inner warnings, which should have confirmed the others for me, the ambassadress of Denmark, an intelligent and resolute woman, and Monsieur le Duc d'Ossune reassured me and told me so positively that I had nothing to fear, that I believed I was safe. Nevertheless, 2 days later, the nuncio, the almirante, and Don Garcia de Medrano, from the Royal Council and the Chamber of Castile, came to speak to me on behalf of the king when I least expected it. The purpose of this visit was to make me return to the convent, which they said I should not have left without the permission of His Majesty, since I had entered it by his order. The Almirante, who was the first to speak, told me that he had come solely as a representative of the king's will. When it was the nuncio's turn, he added that he had come to facilitate the execution of that will and to overcome any obstacles that the nuns might put up against it. And the last, speaking as Minister of Justice, told me rather haughtily that he had orders to take me away, and that should I refuse to consent, he would not leave my person and would keep me under very tight guard. I would not have been very worried that he might keep his word, and that threat alone would never have made me give an inch. But the Marquise, for her part, was entreating me most earnestly to go, expressing to me how unhappy she would be if any violence were done to me in her house because of my refusal to obey the king's orders, saying that I would do better to follow them, and that once I was in the convent, I could come out again later with the consent and the authorization of His Majesty, so that in the end she compelled me through her timid reasoning to condescend to return there. And so she accompanied me in a coach belonging to the king. The nuncio wanted to take the nuns by surprise, so he went ahead and had the gate opened, ordering that it should remain open as if he had had the intention of leading in some seigneur. I arrived at this time and found the Duc d'Aveiro, who had learned along the way as he was coming to see me at the Marquise de Mortara's house, that I was returning to the convent, and so he had followed the nuncio there to wait for me. He gave me his hand as soon as he saw me and escorted me all the way into the convent, where several nuns who had recognized me as soon as I had taken off my mantle began to fill the air with their cries, pouring out to the nuncio all their displeasure at seeing their privileges violated. The nuncio finally found himself obliged to send his coach to fetch the provincial, who lives at Notre Dame d'Atocha, outside the gates of Madrid, and who came straight away. He made them see reason and compelled them to conform to His Majesty's decree, which the nuncio read out to them once the two of them had quieted the din that the differences between factions had raised among them. For it is practically impossible that in a community of 130 people, all with different inclinations, the opinions should not be similarly divided. That day I sided with the faction who opposed me. And despite my despair over the violence that was being done to me, I took pleasure in their division, and to foment it, I pointed out to them how strange and unheard of it was that there should be so little regard shown for their privileges, and then as if it were not enough that these had been violated when they were obliged to receive me the first time, they had been compelled to do it again after my first exit, and they were being forced to do it once more after my second. I love her. She's hilarious.
She's great. And later I realized that was probably not a good thing.
Oh, man. Marie stayed in Spain for most of the rest of her life, in various situations, such as in convents, and once even under the same roof as her husband, but not with him. After her memoir was written, she lived another 37 years. And like her sister, Marie never went back to her husband. The rest is history. Sarah Nelson translated the memoirs of the Mancini sisters, Hortense and Marie, from the oldest unedited French versions of the texts that were available. Previously, the last translation into English had been done from a redacted version of the memoirs in the 1700s. This new translation was published by the University of Chicago Press just last year as part of the series, The Other Voice in Early Modern Europe, which presents women's voices and writings. Sarah is on the faculty of the Foreign Language Department at the University of Idaho. When we pay attention to people of the past, we're bound to find heroes, people to emulate, to admire, or simply to be grateful to for how their lives affect ours today. In our final installment in this Yin Radio show called Her Story, Ana Maria Roque tells the story of one of her heroes, Inez Milholland, the woman on the white horse.
One of those suffragettes is a personal feminist heroine of mine, and here is her story. My feminist heroine is Inez Milholland, also known as the woman on the horse that led the suffragists in the March for Women's Rights. Mr. President, how long must women wait for liberty? Those were her last public words before she suffered a sudden collapse from pernicious anemia while delivering a speech in California. Suffragist, lawyer, athlete, activist, public speaker, and World War I news correspondent. She was a remarkable woman indeed. Born in Brooklyn, New York on August 6, 1886, she was the eldest daughter of John and Jean Milholland. Her father was a New York Tribune reporter and editorial writer, who eventually headed a pneumatic tubes business that provided his family a privileged life in both New York and London. Much of Milholland's adolescence was spent in the family's London home, and for most of her life she carried a faint British accent, which added to her charm. In London, she attended the Kensington High School for Girls, a private school noted for its freedom from class distinctions and allowing social classes to mix, perhaps fueling to Milholland's later efforts toward class equity. After attending a school in Berlin, Germany, Milholland enrolled at Vassar College in Poughkeepsie, New York. At Vassar, Milholland pursued herself hard, trying to get all she could out of her college experience. Milholland played many roles in student productions, was part of her current topics club, the German club, and the debating team, as well as the unrecognized but active socialist club. Milholland was also a recognized athlete, and in her junior year won the College Cup for best all-around athlete. During a trip home in London, she was transformed into an ardent political radical when she met the aristocratic suffragette Emmeline Pankhurst. With Pankhurst, she participated in a number of demonstrations in England, and upon returning to Vassar, she wrote in the Vassar Miscellany, the school newspaper, about the English suffragettes, noting the disappointing efforts of American women by comparison. Milholland was determined to bring women's suffrage to Vassar College, and when the college refused women's suffrage speakers to come to campus, she was outraged and took action. She organized a rally on the cemetery barely outside campus boundaries, where the speakers could be heard. By the time Milholland graduated, two-thirds of the student body belonged to the women's suffrage group she created. After graduation, Milholland applied to law schools at Yale, Harvard, and Columbia, but was rejected on basis of her gender. Eventually, she entered the New York University School of Law, from which she received her law degree. During her studies, Milholland continued her suffrage work, as well as other social activism, most notably participating in the shirtwaist and laundry worker strikes in New York City, for which she was arrested. She quickly gained a reputation as one of the most powerful, persuasive, and beautiful orators in the suffrage movement. Her most memorable public appearance was on March 3, 1913, in the Women's Suffrage Parade, the day before President Woodrow Wilson's inauguration, when Milholland cemented her charismatic identity by leading the parade, wearing a crown and a long white cape while riding atop a large white horse. Later that year, Milholland met and married the Dutch coffee importer Eugène Jan Boisvin, to whom she proposed, by the way. The marriage between the two was by no means traditional. Both believed in free love, and Eugène's powerful but self-deprecating personality was always present to support and encourage his wife in her endeavors. In 1915, Milholland diverted her efforts when she joined the Ford Peace Ship in an effort to stop World War I through neutral peace negotiations. During this time, she also served as a war correspondent until she was expelled from her position for her pacifist views. Upon returning to the U.S., Milholland continued her work for suffrage and joined the National Women's Party. Delivering an address on the suffrage store in L.A. on 19 October 1916, Milholland suddenly collapsed. She was hospitalized, and 10 weeks later, on November 25, 1916, the 30-year-old activist died of pernicious anemia. She had known she had a potential deadly disease, but stubbornly continued her fight for the cause. Dedicated to social equity, regardless of class or gender, Inez Milholland was a woman willing to champion the causes of anyone, women, laborers, children, or the poor, who found themselves disenfranchised.
And that wraps up this Yin Radio program called Her Story. Today's end music is by Orchid, and it's Call to the Past. You can listen to past shows or podcast this show, or you can sign up for electronic newsletters at yinradio.org. You can also find Yin Radio on MySpace and on Facebook. You can drop us a line, and please do, at yinradio@vpfound.org. That's yinradio@vpfound.org. Yin Radio is produced at KRFP, Radio Free Moscow in Moscow, Idaho, and heard on The Detour in Tennessee at thedetour.us throughout Appalachia. And it's also on 105.6 FM in Johnson City and on other stations around the country. Yin Radio is a production of VP Foundation. I'm your executive producer and host, Sandy Billings, and I'm glad you joined me. Until next week. Said nothing.